listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. This is interesting. Madison County is... let me get Brian Fisher on here, and except he's not on the board. Oh, he's on Skype. Oh, hey, Brian, welcome.
Hey, Tom, how you doing?
Good, good. Let me introduce you appropriately. You're the host of the Focal Point Radio Show on AFR Talk, the director of Issues Analysis for Government and Public Policy at American Family Association. AFA.net is the website. It's AFR Talk or AFA Talk?
AFR Talk for American Family Radio.
Ah, of course. Okay, great. Welcome back, Brian.
Good to be back.
What state is Madison County in? I'm looking through this article here.
It's in the state of Georgia, I believe.
Uh-huh, okay. And somebody donated arguably a piece of art to them, a stone with a sword to pull out of it and all that kind of stuff. And there were a bunch of Bible verses on it. Do I have that right?
Two Bible verses on it. Yes, that is correct.
And the school board said, okay, we got to take the Bible verses off because we are a public school. We are paid for with taxpayer dollars. And so it's inappropriate for us to basically hang a sign in front of everybody when we're having a football game saying, here you have to, well, you don't have to, but here we're pitching this religion at you. Do I have that right?
Well, yeah, they didn't do anything because of complaints from somebody inside the school. They only acted when they got complaints from something called the Freedom From Religion Foundation, which is grammatically challenged because the Constitution does not guarantee freedom from religion. It guarantees freedom of religion. Maybe they were missing the day they discussed prepositions in elementary school.
Yeah. Well, what's wrong with freedom from religion?
It's not in the Constitution, Tom.
Well, arguably freedom of religion, if you posit that atheism, at least evangelical atheism, is a religion, and I do, that's, you know, freedom of religion. If you have people who don't believe in Christianity who are Hindus or Buddhists or Satanists or whatever, that's all freedom from religion or freedom of religion. And it would be freedom from having a religion imposed on you that's different than yours. I mean, isn't that a reasonable assertion?
Nothing's being imposed on anybody here, Tom. There's no coercion involved. People can believe those Bible verses or not. They can touch the stone or not. The work of art was donated. No taxpayer dollars involved at all.
Yeah, it's a beautiful thing. How would you feel if it was a picture of Satan and, you know, with the upside-down five-pointed star being held over his head, you know, the one that's now on the Republican logo, and, you know, the verse was that verse in... Where is it in the Old Testament, the story of the fall of Lucifer, you know, that he was that speaks actually is sort of favorably of him as an angel before he fell.
Well, again, that goes to the definition of the word religion. What the founders meant by the word religion at the time of the founding was Christianity.
Well, no, they clearly didn't. And I can give you dozens of quotes from founders that refute that. You and I both know that's not true. But you didn't answer my question. How would you feel if it was if the sculpture that had been donated was a sculpture of Satan?
The point of the First Amendment is to protect the free exercise of the Christian faith. These are verses from the Christian Bible, perfectly appropriate. The First Amendment violation is those that are trying to get rid of the public expression of faith in the public schools.
So how would you feel about this, Brian Fisher, if the statue that had been donated was a statue of Satan holding an inverted five-point star, and the cut line was a Bible verse, but it was a Bible verse that spoke well of the angel of the morning?
Well, in the democratic form of government, Tom, that's not how we make decisions. The school board decided to accept this piece of art. They only made a decision when they got pressure from an atheist foundation. It's the atheist foundation that's infringing on the free exercise of religion. They're the ones that are violating the Constitution.
So,
they are governing against the will of the people.
So you're saying then, Brian, if a Satanist group had donated a statue of Satan to the Madison County School, and they had put that statue in their football stadium so everybody could see it when they came to play a football game, and it had Bible verses celebrating Satan, that you would have no problem with that. You think it would be unconstitutional for the school board to say, you know, we really don't want this picture of Satan out here.
No, if the school board decided to do that, Tom, they could have it. That's what freedom of religion is all about. You're the one
right.
that is against freedom of religion and a democratic form of government.
So, yeah, right. Good luck with that, Brian. So what you're suggesting then is that any religion that wants to submit a statue that promotes their religion to a public school that's paid for with tax dollars should be able to. The school should be able to accept it and display it to the kids and everybody else however they want, which leads to an interesting conundrum. What happens when the school board says, you know, we'll take the statue of Vishnu, you know, the Hindu god, but we're not going to take the statue of Jesus, the Christian god?
That's up to the school board, Tom. That's up to the school board, Tom. That's religious freedom, Tom. You're the one that's against allowing the people to make decisions for themselves and govern themselves. You are the enemy of religious freedom here, not me.
So you're suggesting that if the school board decided to go with a satanic statue, that would be fine with you?
If that's what the school board decided, they're elected by the people. If the people decide they don't want a statue to Satan, they can elect a different school board and they can change the policy. That's freedom, right, Tom. That's religious liberty. That's America.
So in your mind, freedom is using our tax dollars to promote Satanism.
That's up to the school board, Tom.
Right. So that's your definition of freedom, is for my tax dollars to be taken away from me at gunpoint, which the IRS has the potential to do, and use those tax dollars to promote Satan. That's your definition of freedom.
Tom, what I'm about is self-governance. I'm about a democratic form of government. I'm about protecting the free exercise of religion. I'm about letting the people govern themselves. This is tyranny. The will of the people in Madison High School is to have this statue with Bible verses on it. It's tyranny to take that away from them. You're the one advocating
tyranny. But Brian, it was nobody held a gun to anybody's head. The school board voted unanimously to take the Bible verses off the statue. Nobody, you know, they were not compelled to do it. There was no force. However, the people who paid their taxes to pay for the stadium, they were compelled. They were compelled by threats of violence, of imprisonment, of loss of their homes. These are property taxes principally support these houses.
Tom, you know this, Brian.
This is the libertarian argument against taxes, but there's some truth to it. And
Tom, you're just being hysterical now.
No,
I mean, Tom, these people need to grow some hair. These people are afraid of a rock with words on it. These people from the Freedom from Religion.
But that's freedom, Brian. That's freedom. They voted. They voted. I thought you were in favor of democracy. They voted to take the Bible verses off. The school board unanimously voted to take the Bible verses off. How is that not freedom?
They wouldn't have done it if they hadn't been intimidated by a lawsuit from the Freedom from Religion Foundation. This is clearly the will of the people.
How do you know they were intimidated as opposed to simply enlightened? They voted.
Because
nobody showed up with a gun.
They had no problem with it until these wusses from the Freedom from Religion Foundation that are scared by words on a rock showed up and threatened a very expensive lawsuit. This is intimidation and bullying and tyranny.
So when somebody challenges, I'm trying to understand this worldview that you're representing here. So when my tax dollars are taken from me at gunpoint, coercively, and used to promote Christianity, that's fine because that's freedom. And when a school board decides that they're not going to promote a religion, say Satanism, or in this case Christianity, they're not going to promote a religion in their taxpayer-funded stadium, and they vote democratically to do that, and this is an elected school board, that is tyranny and they're wusses. Do I have that right?
No. What I am for is religious freedom, Tom, which is a school board has the right under our Constitution to decide what messages they will encourage, they will receive.
Which they just did.
They will support. Exactly right. But they did it under intimidation and bullying. That's tyranny. That's not a Republican form.
I see. So somebody expressing their opinion to a school board is tyranny.
No, being coerced into violating freedom of speech.
Okay,
Brian. That's tyranny.
Okay, you got the last word. Hang on.
This is the Tom Hartman program.
Brian Fisher, you can get his stuff over at afa.net. You listen to his program and see everything that's going on over there. Thank you, Brian, for dropping by.
Welcome, Tom.
Good talking. We'll be back. And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And just a heads up of some of the stuff that's coming up in the program today. In our second hour, Paul Gunter is going to drop by. It turns out that Fukushima radiation is starting to show up on the West Coast. Cesium-134, cesium-137, which clearly came from Fukushima, we're now finding this stuff. So, you know, where do we go with this? And in our third hour, David Quammen is going to be with us. He is a journalist and author of the book Ebola, The Natural and Human History of a Deadly Virus. We're going to get an update on Ebola from an actual scientist as opposed to, you know, what we had earlier, what we had last week, which I guess was Michael Savage saying, I'm an expert on this stuff. You got that queued up? Let's play it. This is the hysteria we've been dealing with.
Stop the music. We have breaking news. And look, folks, I don't want to panic you. I don't want you to get more agitated than you already are. I want to be calm. I want you to take a deep breath. And I have to confirm that the first Ebola case has been diagnosed in the United States. It was released 10 minutes ago. It's exactly my worst fears. They did it to us. Again, I'm not doing this to frighten you, to alarm you, to sell you a book. I'm as sober as a priest right now, as a priest should be. I'm as sober as a pallbearer, as a man should be. I'm as sober as an epidemiologist who went into talk radio to try and enlighten the American people in some decent manner. I'm as sober as I can possibly be, giving you the worst news of my entire life. This did not have to happen. Yes, it is transmitted casually through the air. Never mind what the hacks in the government media complex tell you. Don't you listen to a word this liar says. He should be arrested for a crime against humanity.
Right. So, you know, we'll see where we go with that. I also want to get into a rant. And in fact, I'm going to do it as soon as this break is done, about how the millennials are the first generation since my grandfather who have seen firsthand the consequences of the economic policies that the Koch brothers and the Republican Party promote, and that they use basically, you know, religion to sell. And I just, you know, I find the whole thing fascinating. So an interesting article over, this is The Fix in the Washington Post, Aaron Blake writing this. And he talks about how conservatives are principally getting their information from Fox News, and pretty much everybody else is getting their information from a wide variety of people. But what I thought was really interesting is they pointed out that 34% of consistent liberals cite The Daily Show as a news source. And then the article goes on to say, and while The Daily Show certainly has a liberal-leaning point of view, its express purpose is entertainment, not news. Which raises the question, whose express purpose is news? Because to the best of my knowledge, there's nobody left. I mean, I'll be right up front. This is not a news show. This is a commentary show. I'm offering opinions. But who's left? The news divisions of all the big networks are operating under the entertainment divisions, and they're all about ratings and revenue. CNN, ratings and revenue. MSNBC, ratings and revenue. Pretty much everybody, except Fox News, and Fox News obviously is not about the news either. But they claim to be. We'll be right back. Welcome back, Tom Hartman here with you. Well, we can continue this conversation. In fact, we will continue this conversation about, is freedom from religion, freedom of religion, freedom with religion, all that kind of stuff. But there's something else that I wanted to talk about in this first hour that I see as just an absolutely, in addition to that, I want to talk about, that I see as an absolutely fascinating phenomenon. When I was writing The Crash of 2016, I spent a fair amount of time studying the history of economic crashes in the United States. And one of the ones, the crash of 1856 is fairly well documented. The crash of 1770 is poorly documented, but it's there. But the crash of 1920 through 1929, or the bubble of 1920 through 29, and the crash of 1929 is very well documented. This was my grandfather's generation. My grandfather came to the United States in 1917 from Norway. On my father's side, on my mother's side, my relatives go back to, well before the Revolutionary War. They go back to the mid-1600s. But on my dad's side, My father's father and mother both came from Norway in 1917 or thereabouts. And so my grandfather's generation, which would be for millennials probably great-grandpa or great-great-grandpa or grandma, they were the last one to actually see libertarian/republican economics sold to the American people in 1920. In the election of 1920, Warren Harding ran on a campaign platform that had two pieces to it. One was cutting taxes, the top tax rate then, on millionaires and billionaires, or what would today be billionaires. The top tax rate was 91%. Warren Harding ran on the platform of dropping that to 25%, which he did when he became president in 1921. So number one, tax cuts. And number two, privatization and deregulation. The slogan that Warren Harding used was less government in business, more business in government. In other words, deregulation, privatization. And the conservatives, I'm reluctant to use that word because I don't think that Everett Dirksen would agree with any of this, but the Republicans, the right-wingers of their day, the libertarians of their day, they sold America this bill of goods in 1920 and actually won the election, got a Republican House, a Republican Senate, a Republican president, and on the idea that cutting taxes, deregulating businesses, especially banking and Wall Street, and the oil industry, which had just been aggressively attacked in the preceding generation by both Teddy Roosevelt and William Howard Taft, also Republicans, but progressives. Deregulating all these industries would be a good thing. It would kick off prosperity. And it looked that way for the first couple of years. 1921, 1922, 23, 24 saw this incredible rise in the stock market. Harding died as vice president. Coolidge came in as president. And in the next election cycle, Coolidge was elected. And then, as I recall, Coolidge died too. Maybe not. But, yeah, actually, I think he served out his term, and then Hoover was elected. And it was called the Coolidge Prosperity while Coolidge was president. Basically, you know, he didn't do anything. Silent Calvin, right? He just, we're going to let the billionaires run the country. And the stock market just continued to climb. Now, working people's wages went down during the Roaring Twenties. Poverty increased during the Roaring Twenties. Inequality went up substantially during the Roaring Twenties. A lot of people think because it was called the Roaring Twenties that it was great for everybody. It wasn't. It was great for the 1%, or maybe the top 10%. And then it crashed, and you've got this generation of people, my grandfather's generation, who both heard the sales pitch in the 20s, bought it, voted for this stuff. My grandfather wasn't among them. He was a socialist, but, you know, voted and bought. The majority of Americans voted for this stuff and then saw it collapse. We now have another generation that is seeing this, and that's the millennials. They are seeing these policies. Just 30 years ago, virtually every state in the country required hospitals and insurance, health insurance companies to be not-for-profit organizations. Over the last 34 years of Reaganomics and deregulation, most states have done away with those laws, and a lot of your hospitals and insurance companies are now for-profit corporations. Costs have exploded. Used to be if you wanted to start a school, you had to be a not-for-profit in most states. Now you can start for-profit schools. The cost of education has exploded. Social Security, which was created because people had their savings in the stock market, and the stock market wiped them out. So, starting in the 80s with Reagan, they started selling this idea that Social Security is not going to be here for you. Social Security is going to go away. We need to privatize. Remember, Bush tried to privatize Social Security in 2005 after he was reelected. He said, I got the political capital from my war in Iraq, and I'm going to use it to privatize Social Security. Didn't work out, but he tried. And you got some you got Erskine Bowles and Alan Simpson, running around talking about this stuff, these crazies. But now we've got a generation, the millennials, who are looking around. Now, they may say they like libertarianism. Libertarianism says, hey, decriminalize drugs, decriminalize prostitution, but do all this economic, political stuff, conservative stuff. But I think that they don't understand what libertarians are really all about.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
But that said, they're the first generation in modern living memory to actually experience firsthand what's going on. Look at student debt, for example. Defending America from the weapons of mass deception. Tom Hartman here with you. Okay, help me with this. If you have any suggestions to add to my list, I'm sort of writing an op-ed here on the air. The list of things that millennials are seeing and probably in most cases realizing are basically ripping them off and destroying their lives that are woof and weave, that are part of the fabric of libertarian slash conservative slash Republican economics, because it's really all about economics. They use religion to try and get people to vote. They use guns to try and get people to vote. They use homophobia to try and get people to vote. They use xenophobia. I mean, this is a big one, you know, oh, we got to build a border fence and to get people to vote. But what they're really all about, Republicans, and ultimately what Democrats are really all about, is economics. Do we have an economy that skews toward the top 1 or top 10%? That's the Republicans. Or do we have an economy that skews toward the bottom 90%? That's the Democrats. Excuse me. And so here's the list that I've come up with so far. Millennials realize they saw their or their parents' 401ks go in the tank as a result of the stock market crash in 2008. They realize the stupidity of privatizing Social Security and the importance of strengthening it. They saw Enron deregulated and then do rolling blackouts across California to jack prices up and to evict a sitting governor, a Democrat, Gray Davis, and then Ken Lay conspiring with Arnold Schwarzenegger to run him as governor to get a Republican in the governor's office, the governor's mansion in California. They saw that happen. In fact, we all saw Daryl Issa break down and sob on live television because he thought he put $1 million into the campaign against Gray Davis. He thought he was going to be the guy who was going to be the governor. Sorry, Daryl. Ken Lay had other plans. They saw the Enron implosion. They saw the destruction Enron did on the West Coast, and then they saw the implosion of this company, and you know, because it was deregulated. They saw the deregulation of the banking, you know, and deregulating Enron was basically deregulating commodity markets, energy markets, and principally making it possible for Enron to deal with electricity and fuel and things as if they were commodities. I guess they are commodities, but to regulate, to trade them in unregulated markets. They have seen the deregulation of GMOs or the wide proliferation of GMOs. They're seeing an explosion in cases of autism and early onset of puberty and early forms of hormone-mediated cancers that seem to be associated with certain plastic additives and, who knows, maybe with GMOs. They're seeing a minimum wage worth about 30% less than it was in the 1960s. So, you know, a minimum wage has become a poverty wage. They've seen that they can't start small businesses the way that their parents, grandparents, great-grandparents did because industries are dominated by giant monopolies. What else have they seen that should inform them of the utter insanity of these right-wing policies? So, a lot on the table. Eddie in Galleria, New Jersey. Hey, Eddie, what's on your mind today?
Yes, good afternoon. I totally agree with your conversation with the gentleman who was pushing for, I believe, was some kind of scripture on a statue at the school.
Right,
Brian
Fisher. I
kept the conversation, so I didn't catch it from the very beginning. I agree with you 100%, which I usually do in most cases when I listen to your program, which is pretty often. But there's one thing you said that I did disagree with, and I've heard you say it at least once or twice before, and that is that atheism is a religion.
No, I said evangelical atheism is a religion.
Okay. what is the difference?
Evangelical atheists are people who are out there aggressively. They're evangelizing. They're trying to convert people to their worldview. And that, in my opinion, qualifies as being a religion. Somebody who is trying to convince other people to see the world through their lens. You know, that's a religion. You can't, an atheist can't, a true atheist, if you want to say, if you want to go back to the origin of the word, it's really anti-theist. It's somebody who's opposed to religion. And if somebody is, you know, aggressively and evangelically opposed to religion, that's a religion itself. On the other hand, there are people who simply say, I don't believe in this stuff. Right. And I don't know what's going on. It's like my father. He was really an agnostic. He was not an atheist. And you know, I didn't even know my dad was an agnostic until, you know, a few months before he died. We had a conversation about it. All my life he had taken me to church and everything else because he thought it was the thing to do with kids. Right. But he was not he was not subscribing to the religion of atheism. He was simply a garden variety, doubter.
Yeah, I understand that. I understand what you're saying, but I still think there's a lot of people, including myself, that disagree with that. I mean, atheist in itself means without theist, without religion. And I, you know, evangelize myself personally. And the only thing I could say would become close to evangelizing is that I just like the situation that happened with that school. When I see something like that, I'll make my films about it known. We had a situation in my township where they were doing prayer at the city council meetings, and a few of us got together and complained about it, and then they stopped doing it.
Yeah,
but,
good.
You know, so, but I don't push it, my atheism, or anybody. I don't try to convert anybody. I have no problem with people being religious. I think it's a great thing for people who are into it. I just don't believe.
Yeah, so you are not practicing a religion. You're simply... you're more of a secular humanist, I would say, in all probability.
Actually, I am a humanist. I belong to a humanist group.
Yeah, okay, there you go.
Also,
nothing wrong with that.
I'm a member of a Unitarian Universalist Church.
Yeah.
I'm not an active member of it anymore, but I'm still on the rolls.
Yeah. So, okay, Eddie, I got to move along, but thank you for the call and interesting point. Keith in Shorewood, Wisconsin, you wanted to talk about millennials and libertarianism?
Yeah, actually, you know what? I had seen some research. I think it was from Pew. Of course, your crack staff can look it up. I'm in a car right now. But that said that the millennials, and I think we're talking 21 on up, Tom.
Yeah.
Okay.
I'm not sure, frankly. But yeah, it's people in their 20s, basically.
X's, right. You got Gen X, Gen Y, and I think they're all covered by millennials. I saw. Now, two things make me very optimistic about the millennials. Number one, according to the research, this is the first cohort or generation that actually believes that government is the solution to problems, not the cause of problems.
Right.
And so.
Or can be.
So they.
Yes.
Right. Or they're open to the idea that it is.
Right.
And the second thing that makes me kind of optimistic is this will be a generation that'll be probably the least likely to vote against your self-interest. One of the, you know, if you're talking about things that they're noticing, one of the things, of course, is the student debt that they got to carry.
Right.
When I went to college, 75% of my college was paid for by the state of Wisconsin. Now that amount has totally reversed. And I see them as being the first wedge-free generation in terms of gays, racial minorities, they're not interested in getting all fired up about, you know, how or manipulated in terms of being against these groups. So I think what we're going to see here is a group of people that are going to think more intelligently about their political choices.
Yeah, I agree. And that was my point. Now, the weird anomaly is that they are more of them are self-identifying as libertarian than at any time in history. And in part, you can attribute that to the millions and millions of dollars that the Koch brothers have spent making sure that colleges are teaching Ayn Rand, that they're actually, you know, that Ayn Rand is being taught in philosophy classes and in economics classes, that libertarianism is being promoted, all the money that they put into the Reason magazine and the Reason Foundation, which are, you know, funded by the Koch brothers. And you know, all this stuff. I mean, there's been a real effort. You know, David Koch ran for vice president of the United States in 1980 on the libertarian ticket. There's a long effort to make people libertarian. But when you drill down into their beliefs, the part of libertarian that they get is, you know, live and let live, you know, decriminalize drugs, decriminalize prostitution, no more, you know, putting victimless crime, and let's have a humble foreign policy. And I think that, you know, everybody agrees with that. Not everybody agrees with that, but a lot of millennials agree with that. What they don't realize is that there is this very, very toxic piece to libertarianism, which is the assertion that basically billionaires can run a country better than government can run a country, and, you know, that are antithetical to historical American values. And that's a pretty important one. Keith, thank you very much for the call. Nate in North Fiesta, South Carolina. Hey, Nate, what's up?
Hey, how's it going? Tom, I actually called to talk about the Ebola crisis, but I'm also wanted to make a comment because I am myself a millennial. And I read an article last night and it was saying that the millennials now are the one of the least educated generations as far as college degrees. They were saying there's a silent majority of students who have not finished university by now.
Yeah. And the college dropout rate is startlingly high. I don't know if that's the case, but these for-profit colleges are producing a lot of dropouts. Nate, give me a call. We're really not on the Ebola topic right now, but you know, give me a call back a little later on, and we can get into it. I want to continue to pursue this, both this religion thing and how religion is used by the Republican Party to get people to buy into things like libertarianism.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
It essentially answers the question, what's the matter with Kansas? Or what's the matter with Kansas? Right now, everybody's figuring out it's Sam Brownback, but he's doing Reaganomics. Welcome back. John in Minneapolis watching Free Speech TV. Hey, John, what's up?
Yeah, I just wanted to say, you know, I've heard people call in to your program, you know, and try to refute with you global warming. And, you know, they rely on the propaganda that they've been fed, and they absolutely refuse to, you know, face the facts on these issues. You know, the science just does not support your point of view. And so, I mean, for me, I think, and for a lot of people, if, you know, your view isn't supported by the facts, you kind of look at your view and think, well, gee, you know, maybe I'm not correct. But unfortunately, I think, you know, one of the problems why we're in a standstill politically is that this propaganda, you know, works with a lot of people, with the electorate. I would say probably like a third or a 40%. And, you know, it's kind of scary because this is exactly the kind of thing that philosophers like Hannah Arendt talked about when they were talking about totalitarianism. And the fact that what happens is that people no longer can really tell what's real and what's not real. And, you know, the conversation, you can't politically move in any direction with people that are so intolerant that, you know, despite the best facts, the best information, they will still disagree with you.
All right. And, don't confuse me with facts. My mind is made up.
Beg your pardon?
The old, my mind is made up, don't confuse me with facts.
Yeah, and, you know, I don't know what to say about it because, you know, I called in yesterday to talk about, like, firing line, and I do think that what was in those conversations was a respect for the truth, and you could argue, well, you know, these policies are not going to work because, you know, this information and this policy is just so false. It's going to destroy this, this, and this. And you could make that argument. Today, they don't want to hear it. And, you know, you don't have to respect that. You can just shut people down. And that's the end of it. I remember one program where Fred Friendly, he was a prominent journalist, you know, actually attacked William Buckley, they were talking about the concentration of media. And, you know, this was before the Internet, but, you know, apparently Fred Friendly did his homework and found out that that William F. Buckley really wasn't qualified to talk about it, since he had owned, I think, like 8 TV stations and a couple of radio stations. So he was actually involved in concentrating, you know, the media. This is, you know, in the 70s.
And Fred Friendly ended up the president of CBS, didn't he?
Yeah, and then he went on to teach at Columbia, and he was very well liked. And I think he was an extremely, you know, he was a very good journalist. I don't remember some of the pieces that he did that made him famous, but I do remember that conversation and how he just shut the conversation down because
it's a shame there's not a good archive of firing line shows. You know, they're really hard to find online.
Such a sophist, he could like argue his way out of anything, and he just couldn't argue his way out of the facts.
Yeah.
But today you can, because they just shut you down.
Yeah.
You allow people to talk, and you have an appreciation for the facts, but you know, not so much.
But a lot of these guys don't. Yeah. John, thanks for the call. Interesting observation. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the True People's Media. Talk media for the rest of us, the Tom Hartman Program. Time for our Pigeon Alert for the week. Da-da-da.
Look, up in the sky.
It's a bird.
No, it's a plane.
We are autonomous robotic organisms from the planet Xenu.
And now, a story about a bird.
Right. Well, an Airbus 320 was coming into the Manchester airport in the UK, and the pilot and the first officer both said they saw a man go flying by the front of the airplane at 3,500 feet. He was about 200 meters away from the plane. Zoom! And this rather alarmed them. It looked like Superman. And it wasn't a guy with a parachute, and it wasn't a guy with a parasail outfit. And nobody could figure this out. The British Hang Gliding and Paragliding Association said the weather conditions were so bad it wouldn't have been a lone flyer in the area. But the pilots were convinced they saw it. I think what they saw was a pigeon who had been hanging out in Fukushima. But, you know, who knows? Anyway. Me. Let's see here. Bob in Sacramento, California. Hey, Bob, what's up?
Hi, Tom. Interesting that you, I missed the first segment of the show where he had the, some religion guy on.
Yeah, Brian Fisher was on.
I was going to call about the talk to Reza Aslan yesterday.
Yeah.
And then you continued the subject today, so it's perfect timing. But before I disagree with you, I want to tell you that I strongly agree on the libertarian issue. There, you're absolutely right, and it's insane. The talks I've had with libertarians over the last 20, 30 years, it's the magical thinking on...
it's a religion itself.
It's magical thinking.
Yeah.
And this is where I disagree with you on atheism.
Okay.
Atheism is essentially the default position on the proposition, is there or is there not a God? The person who claims the supernatural has supernatural evidence to provide. That's the burden of proof. You're making the assertion that there is this infinite, omnibenevolent, omnipresent, omniscient being that...
I'm not making that assertion.
Well, no, I'm not saying that you ascribe to that. But in America, in the 21st century, that is mostly what people mean when they talk about...
It's about 70% of Americans.
That would kind of qualify as mostly. And so they're making the assertion that this is the case.
Right.
All right?
Bob, if I may, the Catholic Church has a pope and official positions. They're going through a rather agonizing process right now in determining what their official position is on, for example, gays and gay marriage. But they have a pope in an official position. And so really, you can't say you're a Catholic unless you do the dance that the pope prescribes. there is no pope in Judaism. There is no pope in Islam. There is no pope in Hinduism and Buddhism and, I don't know, Zoroastrianism. All of those other isms you can simply declare. And, you know, like in Islam, you've got ISIS guys who say, in the name of Islam, we are bringing back slavery. When, as Reza Aslam pointed out last night, the first thing Muhammad did when he invented Islam was ended slavery. Right. So it can be as antithetical to the or heretical to the history of the religion as you want. They still call it the religion. I would say the same is true of atheism. I hear from atheists who say that they are anti-theists, which Reza last night was saying is the historical basis of modern atheism. I hear from people who say that they are atheistic, that is, no religion, as opposed to opposed to religion. And there's a very big difference between those two positions. And then I hear from people who are just like, yeah, I don't know. And I think that atheism, just like Protestant Christianity or you know, Hinduism or Buddhism or whatever, it means whatever somebody who claims that they're an atheist says it means.
All right. I heard that's the objection. That's what I want to begin to object to, because this is where it was when, you know, I listened to Reza Aslan last night, and I'm sorry, you guys just don't understand. And let me just make my case here. The position is there a God? That's the question.
No, it's not.
Now, if you
no, that's not the question.
Question about theism is,
atheists are equally opposed to polytheism, which is, are there gods? Atheists are equally opposed. Some atheists are equally opposed to pantheism, which is all of physical creation is animated by something supernatural. And many atheists would say, no, I don't subscribe to that. On the other hand, there are atheists who go, yeah, pantheism's fine with me.
Can I make the opposing argument? I've heard Please. This argument from you and Reza Aslan.
Yeah.
And I'd like to expect.
Got about a minute here. It's all yours, Bob.
Okay, thank you. Now, God, supernatural, whatever, is the spirits, anything, any of these things, do they exist or do they not? Now, if you can demonstrate this, I'd be more than happy to hear any actual evidence that these things exist. Do unicorns exist? Does the flying spaghetti monster exist, to use the ridiculous, to take it to the ridiculous?
Well, I don't think you can prove that they don't exist.
I'm not trying to prove that they don't exist.
Well, that's the position of an atheist. I know that this doesn't exist.
No, that's not true. That's a positive atheism that can be borne out by the fact that in 6,000 years of claims, no one has proven that it does exist, so the reasonable position is to say that it doesn't exist. That's just simply a
reason. Well, then we have an argument over the word
sure,
it.
No one knows anything for sure, including the Big Bang, including whether this table in front of me is actually solid or mostly space, because it's electrons flying around.
Well, I think we know pretty solidly that it's mostly space.
Well, I understand that, but to appearances, it's a solid piece of wood.
Right. So things aren't always what they look like, so maybe atheists should reduce their certainty level.
Tom, I, like most people who believe in God, you filibustered me out of my time.
I'm sorry, Bob. I'm very sorry. We'll do it again. Thank you for the... It's not that I turned off the time. We're just at the top of the hour. We got to go. Bob, thank you for the call. We'll be back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And interesting news out of the West Coast here. Cesium-134, the Fukushima fingerprint, showing up 1,200 kilometers west of Vancouver, B.C. on August 2nd, which was, more than 2 months ago. Paul Gunter is on the line with us. Paul is the director of the Reactor Oversight Project at Beyond Nuclear. BeyondNuclear.org is the website. And, Paul, welcome back to the program.
Hey, thank you, Tom.
Thanks for joining us. So what's going on? What what's happening with radiation hitting the west coast of the United States, and B, I wanted just to get a general update on what's going on at Fukushima.
Right. Well, you know, what we've seen in the news, as you pointed out, is some of the initial tests from Woods Hole Oceanographic Institute. They've been doing seawater sampling off the west coast. So we're now seeing, I think this is like 190 kilometers away, they've picked up sea samples with the radioactive cesium-134 and radioactive cesium-137 out of seawater, totaling about 6 becquerels per cubic meter. Now, this is elevated, and it's, again, it's what they're measuring out of seawater. The cesium-134 is that's the Fukushima signature. We've got lots of cesium-137 from atomic weapons testing, nuclear waste reprocessing, nuclear waste dumping, Chernobyl. But because the cesium-134 has a 2-year half-life, this is what they're picking up as the signature for it's the leading edge of a radioactive plume that started about 3 years ago in the swirling currents of the northern Pacific. And now it's arriving off the coast of Vancouver, B.C., and it will make its way down along the west coast. Probably by next year, we'll be seeing again, this leading edge of a nuclear accident that was released probably 90 petabecquerels. And that's, you know, a petabecquerel is a becquerel with 15 zeros behind it. It's a pretty good dose.
So it's 1,000 trillion.
Yeah. And it's, again, this is an ongoing accident. There's no finality. There's no containment. There's 3 reactor cores that are unaccounted for in contact with groundwater moving under the plant into these radioactive cesspools and then flowing into the Pacific Ocean and, again, joining this ongoing current of radioactive releases
as we speak
into the ocean.
Now, 6 becquerels per meter, per cubic meter, that's, you know, substantial and measurable, but it's not like that's not going to make you glow in the dark or kill you. However, that amount of cesium in the water, cesium, which not just human bodies, but pretty much all animal bodies think of as potassium and absorb into their muscle tissue, that stuff starts concentrating in the food chain, and pretty soon you do have not glow-in-the-dark fish, but at least fish foods that could be driving a cancer epidemic in the United States. Do we not, or am I being alarmist here?
You know, here's what we've known since 1955, according to U.S. Armed Services records, as they were recording nuclear weapons testing fallout. We've known since 1955 that plankton, you know, ultimately the smallest building block in the ocean will magnify radioactive cesiums per gram of plankton 1,000 times a gram of seawater next to it.
Wow.
So the plankton is magnifying this radioactivity, you know, as we're seeing, you know, 6 becquerels per cubic meter, but it's magnifying it by 1,000 times as it's absorbed from the seawater into the plankton. Then the plankton, you know, makes up the bottom of the food chain, and all the predators above it then consume it and concentrate it into their muscle tissue. Now, they are excreting it as well, but, you know, we've seen bluefin tuna, for example, who these fish They spawn off the coast of Fukushima, Japan. Then they migrate over the northern Pacific, and then they feed off the coastal waters of California. And, you know, they pick up all the cesium that's coming off of Fukushima. They bring it over to the west coast, as well as the plume. But, you know, they're also transcontaminating this same cesium as they move in their migratory path. So you never really lose this stuff. It gets, it's just getting moved around. And so, yes, the concern here is not so much these low readings that we're now picking up in the seawater, but the fact that it's bioaccumulating, it's bioconcentrating, and the accident is not over. It's not contained. I mean, what we've seen most recently is, you know, there were plans by Tokyo Electric Power Company and the Japanese Nuclear Regulation Authority to build an ice wall around the Fukushima Daiichi accident, these melted reactors. And they were going to freeze the ground, freeze the dam, and then, you know, divert the water that's flowing off the mountains. And by the way, a huge overflow from this latest cyclone that moved in and saturated the area, just increased the amount of radioactivity washing off of that site into the Pacific Ocean. But, you know, they were going to freeze the ground down to 90 feet, down to the bedrock under the plant. But they've never done anything along this proportion. And in fact, the experiment in the pilot operations has failed. They got basically a warm slushy out of it. They came nowhere near getting it down to an ice wall. And so the this wave of groundwater continues to carry the radioactivity from these melted cores on into the ocean. And you know, we've got this growing tank farm of more than 1,000 of these huge tanks that hold incredible amounts of radioactive, highly radioactive water, a toxic soup in these tanks that has been hastily put together that remains a big concern in the event that we have another large earthquake that essentially causes a reverse tsunami of radioactive water back into the Pacific. Right.
Paul, we just have maybe 20 seconds. Reactor 3 used to have a fuel thing hanging in the air. Is that still going on?
We're still seeing the fuel being moved out of these elevated storage ponds, and you know, they're coming down to the most dangerous part of the high. They move the fuel that wasn't used, you know, the new fuel first. Now we're seeing that they're offloading the more highly radioactive waste now is getting moved into casks, and we're keeping our fingers crossed. So far there have been no publicized accidents involving the movement of this nuclear waste.
Fascinating. Paul Gunter, with the director of Reactor Oversight Project Beyond Nuclear. Hang on just a second here.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
The website beyondnuclear.org. Paul, thanks for dropping by today.
No nukes.
Yeah, there you go. No nukes. Always great talking with you. We'll be right back. And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Mary in Spokane, Washington. Hey, Mary, what's up? Thanks for watching Free Speech TV on Dish Network.
Oh, I love your show. And, Jiminy, we hit on so many doggone points. And that if I wasn't one that had to have a comment on everything, it would... I'm actually driven nuts here going in circles. But first thing I wanted to touch on real quick, like, is you're a big concern, and I love how you really put it out there about the fracking in California and what we're having all over the United States with that fracking issue to begin with, let alone the privatization of public waters by Hershey's, Coca-Cola, Pepsi, and other organizations. I really want to push the fact that GMOs, corporate law, global warming, fracking, Fukushima, you know, in other words, nuclear regulation and water rights, all these things would do fall under what is known as a inherent constitutional rights as mankind that almost all countries have in some way, either through their church, they believe in the inherent natural rights of mankind, or in their constitutions, they state it. And with that, if the people would start in invoking those rights where they've been stagnant or forgotten for so many years, that they, if they could just invoke those rights right now, that every single case that I mentioned would no longer be an issue. Corporate law, all of it would slowly, it would unweave the tapestry that we have going on of greed.
Yes and no, Mary, because what you're going to see is that the people on the right are asserting that by regulating, for example, the amount of pollution the Koch brothers' paper plants can dump into the water or into the air, or the amount of pollution that their refineries can put into the air, you are limiting their human rights. And then, of course, on the other side, you've got people saying that go ahead.
Here's a perfect example. If this is how corporations are trying to say it, the corporate leaders are saying, like you were talking about how this one company was like, oh, we didn't have anything, we didn't know anything about it. It was the lower level guys that made those decisions, and we shouldn't be held accountable. That's what we hear everywhere from BP, all of them, right? But in reality, if I was driving a car down the road and I met some cool people at a park and they were like, hey, you want to bring us to the bank? We're going to go to the bank and then we'll take you to a party. And I said, sure. And I unwittingly sat outside there and the people ran in and robbed the bank and I didn't know it. And they came out and got in the car and we drove off and we got pulled over by the cops. I would be an accessory to the crime no matter what.
Well,
so
maybe not
CEOs
but,
of these companies.
But I don't think that the CEOs of these companies are doing it in the knowledge vacuum that you're positing in your example. But
no, neither do I. But I'm saying I actually had a friend that went to jail for just said thing. And no matter how much he could claim that he didn't really know these people, he still went to jail for 12 years.
Wow, that's not good. Mary, thank you for the call. I don't even know how to reply to it. 20 minutes past the hour. We'll be right back. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. A lot on the table, a lot that we've been talking about here. One of the things I wanted to mention, I've got this whole big stack of things that, you know, with kind of relatively small comments, but I think they all add up to a large piece. The fix column, which I think Mr. Saliza usually writes, but right now Aaron Blake has written this column for today's Washington Post. And the title is "The GOP Hates the Lamestream Media Even More Than You Think." And it's basically about how on the right, people who are hardcore right wingers and really believe the sales pitch that, you know, Roger Ailes first made to Richard Nixon back in the 70s in the Nixon White House. He said, let's create a TV network or call it GOP TV, Republican TV. And Nixon couldn't raise the money. And Roger Ailes, a generation later, ran into Rupert Murdoch, who said, sure, I'm a billionaire. And they lost $100 billion a year for 4 or 5 years, and finally started making money with Fox so-called news. And how conservatives basically listen to Fox News and right-wing talk show hosts and visit a couple of right-wing websites, and that's pretty much it. Whereas pretty much everybody else is getting their media from a fairly diverse collection, which includes Fox. And they point out MSNBC cracks the top 10 at 23%, although Fox is watched by mostly liberals, too. But here's the sentence in here that just made my hair stand up. They say the only other outlet approaching the kind of ideological commentator-driven news of the Hannitys, the Becks, and the Limbaughs on the left is The Daily Show, which 34% of consistent liberals cited as a news source they had tapped in the past week. And while The Daily Show certainly has, and this is where they go on to, whenever they point out The Daily Show, then they dismiss it, right? And while The Daily Show certainly has a liberal-leaning point of view, its express purpose is entertainment, not news. Well, I would say that Hannity, Beck, Limbaugh, their express purpose is entertainment, not news, too. Entertainment and commentary. It's what I'm doing on this program. They say, you know, mainstream Americans, 53% get their news from NPR, 52%, also CNN, 39%, local TV, NBC, PBS, 37%, BBC, 34%. But somehow the author of this piece in the Washington Post thinks that all of these non-Daily Show networks and programs are presenting news. And, you know, yeah, they can say it's the news. They can say this is our news program. And then you get the story about the new movie that's coming out, and you're like, why is that the news? Oh, it's the news because the NBC owns Universal Pictures, and Universal is releasing this new movie, so they're putting their talent, the movie stars on NBC News. You know, it's like, no, it's not the news. It's infotainment. It's entertaining, it's informative, and it pushes you, your opinions, or your purchasing, more importantly, in particular directions. Ever since 1988, when in late 87, early 88, all three of the big networks moved because Reagan stopped enforcing the Fairness Doctrine in 1987, within a year, all three of the networks had moved their news divisions, which used to be dedicated to news, filled with journalists, and used to lose money for the networks, moved them under the umbrella of the Vice President of Entertainment and made them subordinate to corporate profit. And that's what's going on now. It's all about corporate profit. It's all and being all about corporate profit means it's all about infotainment. And so, you know, there's really no news out there anymore. And even the news agencies that say that they're news, I mean, the New York Times, the Washington Post, talk to James Risen about whether or not they're news. There are aggressive self-censorship, there's aggressive government censorship, and there's a spin toward what do people want. Let's give them more of what they want. And it's creating this incredible siloization of America. But anyway, I just couldn't let that pass. Ruth Bader Ginsburg, in her dissent on this Texas case, this is fascinating. She said, Wisconsin's law permits a photo ID from an in-state four-year college and one from a federally recognized Indian tribe. Texas, under Senate Bill 14, accepts neither, nor will Texas accept photo ID cards issued by the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs. Now, can you imagine if the Democrats had passed a voter suppression law that said your veterans' ID will not allow you to vote, what the Republicans would be doing with that? They would be out there running around screaming, Democrats don't want veterans to vote. Why are Democrats not saying this about Republicans? Texas Republicans have passed a law that says that if you are a United States military veteran, you have veteran ID, that is not good enough for you to vote. So, you know, good luck, Charlie. And then she goes on to say, those who lack the approved forms of identification may obtain an election identification certificate from the Texas Department of Public Safety, but more than 400,000 eligible voters face round-trip travel times of 3 hours or more to the nearest DPS office. Wow. I think you can safely say Greg Abbott's going to win in Texas. Tragic.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
This is the Republican way. Get it close enough to steal, and then have Jeb Bush have Catherine Harris do a merge purge and knock 80,000 African Americans off the voting rolls.
Yeah.
Talk media for the rest of us. Welcome back to the place where smart people get the news, the Tom Hartman Program. And, boy, we are all over the place here. Billy in Wimberley, Texas, you are convinced that millennials are Republican, are turning Republican because they don't believe in socialism. Do I have that right?
Well, I live in a very eclectic world out here in Wimberley, South Boston, and I'll tell you, the millennials that I talk to are very disenchanted with Obamacare. They don't believe that guns kill people outright. They don't believe that we should be forced to accept gay marriage just because they want to be married and steal the language from us. They're coming up with reasonable arguments that they're telling me, and I'm a conservative. So I think millennials are starting to wake up to the lack of fact that's in your utopian vision for this country as perpetrated upon us by Barack Obama and his ilk.
It's interesting. It sounds like we're talking to different groups of millennials. So you're suggesting that young people are not benefiting, or at least don't understand that they're benefiting from being able to be on their parents' health insurance until they're 26. They're not benefiting from the expansion. Well, obviously in Texas, they're not benefiting from the expansion of Medicaid because Rick Perry won't expand it. So, you know, the one in four people in Texas has no health insurance because Rick Perry won't give it to them.
Well, let me.
So I can get where they'd be upset about that.
A guy told me the other day, young people are mostly, usually, very idealistic when they're young and very liberal, right? So we're talking about health care, and this guy's been in the health care business. He's about 25. And he told me, he goes, if there's anybody in the country, anybody in the world more heartless than an insurance company, it's the federal government. And if you think this is what he told me, if you think for a moment the federal government's going to look out better for you than somebody you pay a premium to, you're nuts. Now, that's
wow.
Not to say
that guy is seriously deluded, Billy.
Faults, and the insurance industry didn't have its faults.
That guy is seriously deluded.
What Obama told us was a lie, and people are getting that. These guys are getting that, Tom. They're not stupid.
That guy is seriously deluded, Billy. I love that quote from FDR where he said, you know, better a government that occasionally makes a mistake in an effort at compassion. I'm paraphrasing this. I don't remember the word for word. Than one, you know, frozen in the ice of indifference. The government programs that guarantee employment, that provide for people who are injured, you know, Social Security disability, that are long, you know, anti-poverty insurance for old age, which we call Social Security, health insurance. I mean, you know, obviously he lives in Texas, so he doesn't have access, if he's low income, he doesn't have access to free health insurance that he would have access to if Rick Perry had simply said yes. But it sounds like, you know, what you're saying, Billy, is that Fox News, right-wing talk show hosts, have actually succeeded in convincing you and this 25-year-old that you would be better off trusting a billionaire who runs, and I mean literally, Stephen Jay Hemsley, the guy who runs United Healthcare, has taken over $1 billion in pay, a billionaire who runs a health insurance company that you can't elect, you can't vote for, you have no say over. You'd rather trust him than a government that you actually elect. Do I have that right?
Are you there?
Yeah.
Okay. The proof is in the pudding, Tom. Obama said that that Obamacare would reduce premiums by $2,500. Mine, I know, went up. All right. He also
on average, premiums have gone down, Billy.
Providers are leaving the system in droves.
Billy, I'm not going to debate Obamacare with you. It's working well. You have John Kasich, the Republican governor of Ohio, came out yesterday and said, Obamacare is working well. Of course, he was one of the ones who, unlike Rick Perry, said, we'll take the Medicaid money, we'll expand it. And it's helped the people of Ohio. Republican governors are doing this. It's really not all that debatable anymore. My point is that you're suggesting that this guy and you actually believe this stuff. And I just think that that's a real testimonial to the power of right-wing media. I don't know how to address it beyond that. Anyhow, Billy, thanks for the call. We'll debate all this another time. Number 12, taxi driver number 12, listening to KTRC in Santa Fe, New Mexico. You wanted to talk about millennials and Obamacare?
Yeah, I'll have to follow up saying my personal experience was, you know, this is what the millennials are experiencing. My experience was kind of like that previous caller's, every single person where I work that I can, I interact with, let's say we make anywhere from, I don't know, I can't quote what other people make, but $25,000 to maybe $75,000 a year. We all had our insurance policies canceled. I had my insurance program canceled. And a distant second replacement is the premiums, like literally double to triple the price. And that's after factoring in the Obamacare welfare subsidy, where I'm supposed to go to this site and calculate my income. And it says, you know, the government will give me a $138 a month subsidy. To replace what I had, it's somewhere between $750 a month and $900 a month when I was paying about $250 before Obamacare kicked in.
If you were paying $250 a month for health insurance, you didn't have health insurance.
I had really good health insurance, actually. It was called SCI. It was state coverage insurance, and it was through the state of New Mexico, and it was administered by one of three different companies, which is either Loveless, Presbyterian, or Molina. You know, it's for people who didn't have insurance through their employer. And it was awesome insurance, and I had it canceled, and I can't get it back.
So you had insurance through a state subsidy. So really what you should be working for, Bill, number 12 there in New Mexico, is for that state to do something like Vermont is doing. Let's create a state-based single-payer healthcare system and get these damn health insurance companies out of the loop.
Whatever it may be, Obamacare is not affordable care. Obamacare is unaffordable care.
Okay.
It jacked my premium, depending on what kind of deductible I want. It's double to triple what I was paying before.
Yeah, your experience, number 12, assuming that what you're saying is actually true, and I believe you. We've been talking for a lot of years. Your experience is you are the outlier. You are the exception to the rule. Most people are seeing their insurance rates go down, their health care costs at least stabilize. The rate of increase has radically been cut since over the last previous decade, really two decades, since the Reagan wave of states allowing for-profit hospitals, for-profit hospital acquisitions, and for-profit insurance companies. But anyhow, thanks for the call and sharing your perspective on that. Chris in Rockford, Illinois, you want to get back to atheism?
Yeah, I can't hear you now.
Can you hear me now?
Okay, I can hear you now.
Okay.
Yeah, about the definition of atheism, you had described it as anti-religion, and I don't think that's a responsible thing for you to do.
Well, I'm echoing what Reza Aslan said last night on my television program. He's a professor of this stuff, that
okay.
the term atheism really gained currency in the early 19th century, the early 1800s, and it meant anti-theism, anti-religion, people who were anti-religion, people who thought that religion was a destructive force, the kind of Karl Marx, religion is the opiate of the masses, worldview. It was not atheism, you know, a as in the Greek, not. I think it's Greek.
Yeah.
It actually started out as anti-theism and got abbreviated as atheism. Yeah, go ahead.
My concern, Tom, is about the vilification of the term itself.
Yeah.
People are, you know, the view of an atheist is pretty bad. But I think it's undeserved.
Yeah, I agree with you. I think that there is, and this is something that Reza talked about last night, too, is that atheists and Muslims are the least approved of categories in the United States right now, even with approval ratings even below that of Congress, which is pretty frightening. And
that's unfortunate.
You know, I think atheism has a noble ancestry, and you know, I absolutely respect atheists and atheism. It's just that when an atheist wants to try to convert me to their worldview, I will point out to them that they're behaving as if they were religious.
Well, anyone who wants to convert somebody else is a jerk.
Well, anybody who wants to convert somebody else is an evangelist.
Right, and they're a jerk.
Well, could be. I mean,
with regard to belief in the existence of a god or gods, you either have it or you don't. There's only two states of being there.
Not necessarily. I think that there's a lot of people who've had experiences in their lives where they go, you know, I think there's something out there, but I don't know that it's necessarily, you know, an old guy with a beard.
No, it's not about a specific definition. It's about whether or not you have the belief in a god or gods. You either do or you don't. If you question it, then you don't have the belief. You do not possess the belief.
But if you question it, you don't have the, sure, you don't have the belief, or you don't have the certainty, let's say. But that doesn't mean that you also have certainty.
Nobody is certain about regard to belief in gods, because there has never been any evidence for any.
Oh, I know people who are absolutely certain. I mean, they may be wrong, but they're absolutely certain.
Yeah,
it's like people who believe in libertarian economics. I mean, they're wrong, but they're absolutely certain.
Yeah, well, with regard to belief, my concern was about the term atheism and about, you know, your voice is well-respected and reaches far and wide, and I would appreciate it if you wouldn't say anti-religious, because, I mean, we're all born atheists. We're all born without the belief.
No, actually, I think little kids think that their parents are gods.
You what?
I think little kids think that their parents are gods, and I think that that's why we grow up to anthropomorphize gods, to visualize gods as, you know, giant versions of our parents. It's a developmental process, I think. And that's why I think a lot of religions, particularly those that most heavily anthropomorphize gods, tend to infantilize their adherents, their followers. Chris, thanks for the call. We'll continue the conversation.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
So first I angered the atheist, now I've angered the religious. You can't win. We'll be back. And welcome back. Brian in Matthews, North Carolina, watching Free Speech TV on DirecTV. Hey, Brian, you wanted to talk about millennials and values?
Yes, sir. How are you, Tom?
I am well. How are you today?
I'm doing well. I'm angry. No, I'm kidding.
Okay.
I'm kidding. I'm angry. I want to touch on a few topics here, but my first was with the millennials. I heard you compiling a list there as to what they're living through now,
right.
What they're seeing now as a result of, you know, politics, religion, social structure, and so on. One of my things that really bothers me, and it's bothered me for a number of years, is the access, information and otherwise. Now, if you remove the internet, where would these kids be today, truthfully? I mean, because they think they're so in the know by merely tapping their smartphones and everything pops up for them, true or untrue, but they think that's instant information. And, you know, and it's speculative, subjective, what have you. But the access, because it's so streamlined, so trimmed down, they're only allowed to go to certain places and do certain things, and they have to believe in that system. So if it's already rigged and set up for them, then it's truly not information. It's truly not, it's not true. It's not real. They have to take what's there, what's afforded to them. So I think when we were younger, and it's probably spinning off the topic, but when I was younger, I'd go somewhere, in the 80s, and if I want to work somewhere, a name dropping, go right into a company because they trusted you. Now these kids all have to have these college degrees. They have to have this, have that, have that. So they're truly not afforded the access to a lot of services that they think they are. Secondly, they don't trust in government. They're actually living through that to where when we were growing up, we weren't fully, wholly invested in government, but we trusted them a little more. These kids absolutely are anti-government. They don't even want anything to do with them.
Mm-hmm.
They're just there to screw them, take advantage of them, and what have you. So they're living through those times now. So it's hard to, I don't want to say convert, I hate that term convert, but it's hard to get them to get on board to see that, you know, if you do this, if you vote this way, it's going to help them in the long run, because they don't believe any of it.
Right.
So how do you move that faction? How do you get that group going? Now, I wasn't going to talk about this, but the guy with the atheism view, anyone who's trying to move you into their realm and pull you into their circle, that is a religion. To me, more of a cult following. Because a lot of these people, I don't think they really believe. It's just a comfort level where they just go in with people of their same mindset, same ilk.
I think one of the things that we have to acknowledge, Brian, is that religion isn't just beliefs. Religion is identity. Religion is tribe. Religion is, you know, somebody says, I am a Christian, or I am a Jew, or I am a Catholic, or I am a Muslim. They're not just stating a belief system.
No, it's social.
They're stating an identity.
Exactly. In the 80s, I don't even go to family reunions. Because even back in the 80s and the 70s, we'd go, you see how they all would go in their separate little queues. No one was sharing the common pit, what have you. They would all be in their separate things talking about the other ones. And these were family members.
Yeah.
So what do you think the world at large is going to be?
Right. Welcome to human nature.
Yeah, exactly. We don't do anything that's social, that's commonplace, as long as it benefits me only. if you see that in your own family structure, the larger platform is just playing itself out.
Yeah.
I think we're getting exactly what we deserve. Here we are.
Yeah. Well, you could argue that. But I still think that this concept of religion as identity rather than belief system, which would include atheists. You know, I am an atheist. That's part of my identity. Therefore, I think of myself in these categories. I think that that's also a statement of identity, which is fine. I'm not attacking to criticize it. Brian, thank you for the call. We will be back. It's 10 minutes before the hour. Let's check in with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, for what's going on in the world, brought to you by goatsfortheoldgoat.com and free-don.org. And Bob Ney is on the line with us, author of Sideswiped and reporter with the Talk Radio News Service. Congressman, welcome.
Thank you, Tom. Would you like to go to Ebola or a little Senate politics first?
I'll take the Senate politics.
I thought so. I wanted to mention, of course, tonight is the huge debate. Senator Jean Shaheen, Democratic member, from New Hampshire, and she is leading challenger Scott Brown. She's leading by about 3 to 5%, depends on which poll, you know, what you want to look at. But a lot of people are going to look at that race. And it's very interesting because this has kind of been the week of a voter suppression legal situation, as you know, in the sense that the ID laws are out there all over the place. There are some federal standards, which were in HAVA, Help America Vote Act, which produces your last four of your Social Security, et cetera. You can produce a bank statement. But the states have carried it, as you know, quite farther. And the reason I mention this, because as we're on the heels of this entire vote towards the Senate and who's going to run it, if you look at the total spent by the Democratic campaigns of $104 million, and then the Republican campaigns, quote, of $80 million. But if you really look at the groups, then the Republicans have spent a ton of money, or groups, I should say, pro-Republican, obviously the Koch brothers, et cetera. So they are outspending it in the area of the Republicans against the Democrats. The total spent by the GOP outside groups is $127 million. So it's big money. The only thing that they are trying to stop, of course, is are the voters. And if you take close elections and you take 3 to 5% of minority voters who may not vote due to the IDs and being able to acquire them, and now long lines, this is an edge that kind of a Machiavellian edge, Tom, that is definitely out there amongst the hodgepodge of state laws trying to toughen the IDs.
Well, this is how George W. Bush won in 2000. He would have lost Florida by 80,000 votes if Catherine Harris hadn't gotten that felon list from Texas, compared it with a list of eligible voters in Florida, and it was actually far more than 100,000, but they ended up finding 80,000, quote, matches, end quote, and knocked 80,000 people off the, but largely African-Americans, off the voting rolls in Florida, which got that race close enough to steal, basically. And that's the bet that that Rick Perry is placing in Texas right now, or that Greg Abbott is placing. And I think it's a bet that's going to play off, that's going to win for him.
Yes, and there's a report by the U.S. Government Accounting Office, and that was requested by Senators Sanders, Leahy, Durbin, Schumer, and Nelson. And that report is showing that minority turnout was reduced 2 to 3% in the states with ID laws. Now, those are states, Tom, despite no ID fraud.
Right.
Nothing.
Right. No, this is voter suppression, pure and simple. Paul Weyrich famously said, you know, our leverage in the elections, quite frankly, goes up as the voting populace goes down. He said that back in 1980 when he was helping run the Reagan campaign, and it's been their mantra, and when he was helping found ALEC, and it's been their mantra ever since.
Yes, and so getting out the vote is going to be the important measure.
Yeah.
And as these elections, you know, are considered close, it is still far from over with, with the Senate.
Oh, yeah.
By any stretch of imagination, it's going to be a large part of the turnout. So I did.
Well, and there may even be a couple of runoffs, so we may not even know after November 4th.
Well, that's true. And of course, the ballots, provisional voting, may hold the elections, you know, at bay for a few days, but at least it will have accuracy in voting, because that's where the fraud factor comes in. If you have provisional voting, then you can weed out the fraud. It may just take a couple more days to find out, you know, who's the sitting member.
Right.
So I did want to mention that. The Ebola czar, and of course the headlines are that the Ebola czar won't testify, but the actual reality of Congressman Issa's hearing this Friday is that there will be officials from the Obama administration, from Homeland Security.
Oh, Daryl Issa. Oh,
I know.
Geez, Bob.
I know. I threatened to actually leave the committee one time if they put him on it.
Did you really?
Oh, yes. I privately went out to Ted Vandermeer with the Speaker of Hastert's office, and I said, you know, Issa came to me, and he wanted on House Administration, and I told them at that time they weren't trying to get me to resign, and at that time I told them if he goes on, I quit.
Wow.
I just couldn't handle it.
Do the other, I mean, you were a Republican congressman. Do the other Republicans view Daryl Issa as a weird grandstander, or is he well-liked?
Yes, the other members of the committee, and, the, you know, I always keep it private with the Democratic or Republican side, came to me, and I more Republicans than Democrats, and said, please, whatever you do, do not put him on the committee.
Yeah, wow.
They didn't want to deal with him.
Wow.
And, you know, he's going to have this Friday hearing, but the I don't know if they're going to make a big issue about the czar. It's going to be very difficult because he really isn't taking his position
right
at this point in time.
Right. Plus, any time that the Republicans start screaming about this, all anybody from the administration has to say is, we would have a Surgeon General who would be dealing with this stuff if you guys hadn't filibustered him for almost 2 years.
And that's the other issue. And also, the no travel is starting to lose some of its legs, including Senator Mitch McConnell down in Kentucky, who said that his answer was due to some press person taking shorthand the wrong way. In other words, he was backing off of stopping, you know, all travel.
Yeah, because, you know, the if you try to stop travel legislatively, what you do is you end up with people coming in, you know, basically lying about where they've been, and then you actually lose control of what's going on rather than gaining it.
Yes. And, Tom, there's another report out today I did want to mention, and it's about the IAEA, of course, which is the International Atomic Energy Agency. It's a fascinating report that's coming forth, and it's talking about how the Bush administration worked with some key people, an IAEA official, and they purposely put a strategy to misrepresent Iran's position on the intelligence documents.
Hmm.
So, I mean, it's really, it shows where they actually also pressured El-Baradei, who was, you know, one of the officials with the IAEA, and he attempted to clear up six problems that Iran had, and they just put the hammer down on him when he attempted to do it, and that allowed them to get more sanctions, which was kind of a build-up to make Iran, quote, non-cooperative, which might have fit into the Cheney invasion plans
right.
that they never got to carry out.
Right.
And I mention this because the Bush administration is skating on that report that's coming out. They're taking a skate on that. They really didn't.
You mean the Obama administration?
Yes.
Very interesting. Bob Ney, author of Sideswiped. Check it out at talkradionews.com. Thank you, Bob.
Thank you.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And on the line with us, David Quammen, journalist and author. His latest, Ebola, The Natural and Human History of a Deadly Virus. The website, davidquammen.com, Q-U-A-M-M-E-N. David, welcome to the program.
It's good to be with you, Tom.
Thanks for joining us. You've done extensive research on Ebola, and I'm curious your thoughts on particularly given that a lot of the people who were in close contact with Thomas Duncan, the Liberian man who came here, who came to Texas and ended up infecting these two nurses, that the people who were close to him, the woman who was apparently sleeping with him, the kids who were in the house with him, none of them appear to be infected. The 21-day period has passed, and it looks like this is a lot less contagious than we might have thought. Do I have that right?
You do, yeah. Yesterday was a big day for Ebola news. The fact that those, 43 people were cleared after the 21-day period. I mean, the fact that those two nurses had gotten infected in Dallas and then that a nurse had gotten infected in Madrid also really was spooky. It shouldn't have happened. And it made people start to wonder about this whole thing about Ebola being difficult to transmit and transmitting only by direct contact with bodily fluids. Now with these people in Dallas having been cleared, we're back to what we thought we knew about Ebola and what we apparently can rely on, which is that generally it is quite difficult to become infected, to contract this disease. You need to be unlucky and have direct contact with bodily fluids.
Yeah, and the way that viruses work is they hijack a cell, turn it into a virus machine. When the cell has converted enough of its own material into viruses, into millions in some cases or billions of viruses, the cell explodes, it ruptures, and those viruses spill out. And apparently this is going on really aggressively in the alimentary tract, the GI tract, from mouth to butt. You know, that so when people throw up or when they have diarrhea, those fluids are rich with these exploded cells, with thus, you know, hundreds of billions of viruses. But
that's right, yeah.
Pretty much everything else, not so much.
That's right. And you can think of that as its evolutionary strategy for perpetuating itself, for getting itself transmitted. I mean, viruses, people argue about whether they're actually alive. They're very, very simple organisms, but they are subject to Darwinian natural selection. They do evolve, and they have strategies for living and for replicating. And for Ebola, that's the strategy. They cause bodily fluids to flow out of a victim carrying the virus with them so that it has a chance then of getting into the next host. And it flows out by way of, as you said, by way of vomit, diarrhea, and other bodily fluids. But it does not come out on a breath unless that breath actually contains maybe a little bit of a spittle, a spatter of saliva. We know that it also exists in saliva.
Right. So What's your assessment of what's going on in West Africa right now?
Well, it's horrible. There's a horrible tragedy happening there. And the real concern now, I think, is that as we get the situation under control in the U.S. and people start to be a little bit less freaked out about the idea of Ebola having been transmitted in the U.S., as that story starts to go away, if it's going away, the danger is that we'll forget about West Africa, and that would be horrible. They need much more help from the international community over there. They need more money. They need more experts, healthcare workers. They need more material supplies. And as we've seen, the projections are if they don't get those and if we don't help to contain this epidemic there soon, it'll be thousands. The one prediction from the WHO is tens of thousands, 10,000 new cases each week in the worst case scenario.
Now, Nigeria has been declared Ebola free.
Yeah, that's another.
What do they know that Liberia doesn't, or what do they have that Liberia doesn't?
Well, they've done what you're supposed to do. They had enough people and a strong enough healthcare system that they isolated the cases that they had very quickly, and they traced contacts and they monitored and isolated those contacts, and they managed to contain it while the numbers were still small. I believe they also had some important help from some international organizations. Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, I believe, put $50 million in there quickly to convert malaria clinics that they had helped establish into Ebola treatment centers. I believe that's accurate. And so this combination of things made it possible to contain the outbreak in Nigeria to 20 cases, of which 8 were fatal. And now Nigeria has been declared Ebola-free. That's a huge relief, and it's a huge victory for what we thought we knew and what indeed we can count on, as I said, as the ways to control this virus.
Yeah, especially since this was popping around Lagos and, you know, one of the
that was
most,
very scary.
Yeah, yeah, crowded, yeah, and highly populated cities in the world.
Right.
So what is it that Americans need to know, and what do we need to be doing? I mean, the president has called for money for West Africa. Congress has not chosen to meet, so the president can't just appropriate money. That has to come from Congress. Odds are they won't have even a conversation about this until after the November 4th elections. What do we do?
Well, I think we should call our representatives and our senators and say, look, this is really serious. The U.S. needs to step up, just as other members of the international community need to step up and vastly multiply the amount of support that we're sending to West Africa. And if you're just concerned about Americans, even the best way to protect Americans is to end this thing in West Africa. That means we need to be sending them more experts, more money, to buy more supplies, to create more treatment centers, and deal with this thing by much stronger measures than have been applied so far.
Yeah. We need Congress to come back and do their job. Good luck on that, but I agree with your call for action. David Quammen, journalist and author. His latest is Ebola, The Natural and Human History of a Deadly Virus. His website, David Quammen, Quammen.com, and Twitter, at David Quammen. David, thanks a lot for dropping by today.
Yeah, good to be with you, Tom.
Great talking with you, and I appreciate all the information that you bring to this. Remarkable. Nate in North Augusta, South Carolina. Hey, Nate, what's on your mind?
Yes, I would call it earlier about making a comment about the Ebola epidemic. My mother is a nurse in a private hospital here, and from what I've seen, interviews from experts, and then from her reaction and hearing about other people's reaction there in the ER, they are not getting the proper education at work, and I think this has a lot to do with the fact that it is a private hospital.
And it's a for-profit hospital?
It is.
Yeah.
And they all seem to be listening to right-wing media pundits who are talking, you know, making this whole thing scarier for everyone, and even saying things about how concerned they were that, oh, it's probably actually transmitted through the air. And this was very shocking to me that there was no real education going on in these private, although they are responding in some way, they're not, I don't think they're putting the full government guidelines in place, which I'm not sure if they're actually required to or not. But,
yeah, I have two kids who work in healthcare, one in a hospital, the other in a private clinic, and the horror of the horrible downside of what happened in Texas is that we have two nurses who may die a horrible death and are very, very sick right now. Upside of it is that all over the country, healthcare providers, particularly nurses, are sitting up going, "Oh," and learning, educating themselves, figuring out what needs to be done, and demanding that they have, the help and assistance that they need. And frankly, in some cases, demanding that they have a union representing them, that somebody can stand up to the bean counters who are running these for-profit hospitals and say, no, you actually do need to buy a moon suit for me before I walk into that patient's room. Nate, thanks for the call. I get it. We'll be back. It's 12:15.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Atheism, private corporations, libertarian theology, destroying the millennial generation, a lot going on. And welcome back. Rolando in Granada Hills, California, watching Free Speech TV. Hey, Rolando, what's up?
Yeah, thank you, Don. I want to rebuttal what Reza said in his program yesterday. And by the way, he have 1 hour to explain his point of view, we the people who don't believe this kind of have read the history, we just have a few minutes, a few seconds before our statements go to the people. You know, Reza say that no one of the religions say that go and kill. Perhaps he haven't read.
No, he said all of them say that.
No, hold on. Let me finish because he have 1 hour. I want in my statement, please.
Okay.
That's what I say. You know, he have 1 hour. You progressive people. No. He haven't read the Leviticus. He said that you have to take your own son and get killed by the people whenever he disobeyed you, you know. And I am sure that the Quran have a lot of those things that the people take literally. Whenever one of those rabbis say something, even when it's a falapo thing, you know, they go through and exercise this thing. So there is a plenty examples, you know, that we have in history how the religion have inflicted tremendous damage to the evolution of humanity. But you have this kind of people who have the whole hour to explain in our side. You don't have like Richard Dawkins, you know, to give 1 hour to explain, prepare, and explain all those kind of things. So he is absolutely wrong when he say that no one of the religion say or the books say that the people don't kill the people. It's totally wrong in this thing. But
he didn't say that, Rolando.
And no,
he did not say that.
I remember this doctor that called you ignorant. You know.
No, you are attacking Reza Aslan for saying something that he didn't say. He said the opposite of that. He said every religion sanctions killing innocent people. Every religion.
Exactly.
And I said, what about Buddhism? I thought that there had never been a war fought in the name of Buddhism.
And
I'm sorry, I couldn't, I didn't hear what you had to say. I was talking. What did you say?
Okay, hold on. Let me finish because we have one out. It's not sanctioned in the any religion when they say to kill your own son in the Bible. You know, it literally say it's not sanctioned in that. You say that you have to kill your own son. I remember this. Doctor, you know, I am a doctor. He called you ignorance a couple months ago, you know, when he's trying to twist the reality, the history that he's already done with his argument. But he called you ignorant. He thought that he was talking to the church, you know, when the people didn't know history. Yeah. The fact is that these people have tremendous resources on their side. They receive about $70 billion, you know, every year from incentives to go and twist the reality. And
who are these money, people that you're talking about?
I'm talking about the religion. Here in our country, they receive up to $70 billion, equal to the budget that the high school used from elementary to now. To then, it's the same amount of money that they receive. They have churches for all over, you know, to twist.
Oh, there's an enormous amount of money in religion,
so
in all religions.
They serve, you know, the people that have a some, again, then they deserve to have some time. And I appreciate you have somebody like Richard Dawkins to rebuttal this man. You know, he have a very well spoke in this matter, but he have all the time to make his argument. That is what he religion
I got it.
Prevailed. You know?
Rolando, thank you. You're an articulate spokesman for your perspective. I appreciate it. We'll be back. It's 20 minutes past the hour. Welcome back. Tom Harmon here with you. JG in Tampa, Florida. Hey, JG, what's up?
Hey, doing good, Tom. I'm actually one of your biggest fans. I've been listening to you for the last 4 years now, and I think you're outstanding.
But?
Superb, sir. But the thing I wanted to address is that the best way I break down atheism is in two categories. That the weak atheists basically say that there's not enough evidence to support the hypothesis of a God, or there's a strong atheist who says God don't exist, or a God don't exist. So for both of them, it's basically one God or multiple gods, doesn't matter, don't believe in it. The other thing I wanted to say to you is when you said that atheism is like a religion, that's really not, because if you take it as
I said, evangelical atheism is like a religion. Not atheism.
Well,
evangelical atheism.
I want to get to that. If you take religion like the TV, you've got your Christian channel, you've got your Buddhist channel, you've got your Torah channel, you've got your Muslim channel. Atheism says, turn the TV off. That's not a religion. You're not watching any TV at all. You don't believe in any of those channels. So the thing I was saying is that when you say that atheism, evangelical atheism is like a religion, that's kind of implying that religion has a monopoly on social gatherings and also has a monopoly on voicing passionate.
JG, not only am I not saying that, I said the exact opposite. I said that religion for many people is also a statement of identity, as is atheism. Some people will say I'm a Catholic, other people will say I'm an atheist, and they're saying it not as much as a statement of belief as a statement of identity.
Well, not everyone says it that way. Like, I don't identify, like, that's not the main thing I identify myself as an atheist. I'm just saying it because of this particular topic. But when you attach the atheism, the evangelical atheism, it puts a religious tone on atheism, which is what we afford. We just totally just don't like that because we're the exact opposite of that. But
I am, to the best of my knowledge, not attacking evangelical atheism.
I am
asserting that it is not that different from the religions that it seeks to replace.
It has certain parallels, like I said, social gatherings and being passionate about your world.
And a very specific epistemology, a very specific belief system, you know, an assertion of knowledge of what's not knowable.
Yes, I understand that part of it. I just don't like that religion is being used as a monopoly on social gatherings. Like, if you go to football games religiously, does that mean watching football and going to games means being a religion?
You know, I suppose for some people it could be religion. I think that there are some political...
It could be taken like that, but if you can use the word religion in such a loose term, then it has no real meaning then.
Yeah. Okay. All right. JG, I'll give you that. Marie in Carbondale, Colorado. Hey, Marie.
Actually, I moved. I'm now in Oak Creek, but that's okay.
Okay.
I thought your show last night on Reza Aslan was absolutely brilliant. Thank you for doing that.
Thank you.
I've been passing his book Zealot out. I just think it's incredible.
Yeah.
I watch Bill Maher religiously, and I use that word intentionally. I saw the debate with Sam Harris and Ben Affleck. And I want to offer something that I got from L. Paul Jones, who's a brilliant theologian and philosopher. He's a Trappist monk. Wrote a wonderful book called Theological Worlds, which I think you would enjoy. This removes the debate from the realm of religion, and the word literally means to come together, and puts it in the sense of what is our faith. And my contention is that all of us have a faith, which is similar to what you were saying last night. All of us have a faith, and we gamble our lives that our particular belief system is worth gambling our lives on. We only have this life to prove it out. We have no irrefutable proof that our belief system, our way of looking at the world, is correct or incorrect. We prove our hypothesis with our lived lives. Does that make sense?
It does. Yeah, it does. And in fact, the extension of that is the assertion that religion is a component of identity, not just a component of a belief system.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And then I wanted to add one other thing that I would suggest you look into. You've spoken of yourself as a mystic last night, and then you talked about pantheism. I would suggest that you're more panentheistic. Pantheism is that the universe is God. It is the total revelation. It
right.
is the totality. Panentheism says that there is a force of life beyond, and the physical is the manifestation of that life force. Sounds kind of like Star
right.
Wars, but that's basically it.
Yeah,
and when I listen to you, you sound more like a panentheist.
Well, it may well be. I mean, I think, you know, if I had to come up with a label, it would probably be deist. You know, if you go back and look at Jefferson's, which I guess is more like the panatheist or panentheist.
Panentheist.
The deists believed that there was something that permeated the entire universe that had some sort of association with what we call intelligence or consciousness, and that it started everything going, but that it was not sentient and it did not intervene. It was not interventionist. Hmm. And
not a puppet master.
Exactly. And that it certainly, you know, that the anthropomorphism of deities, you know, turning the supernatural into, you know, old men with beards and things like that. You know, the deists rejected that. And Jefferson, there was a bunch of them who were deists. It was very popular in the mid and late 1700s. And then it kind of died out.
I would suggest there's a resurgence of it now.
I think so,
too. I think people who come from different belief systems are coming together and saying we have so much more in common, and what we want to do is get to what we have in common and intensify our sense of wonder and our sense of amazement and our desire to seek out, as Einstein said, the mind of God, but to seek out what's going on in this universe that we are privileged to be a part of.
Well, and
I think that move. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, that's quite all right. I think the most important point in my mind is that if we are going to save this world from our rendering it uninhabitable for us, we need to resacralize it. We need to once again view the world as a sacred thing. And maybe the word sacred is the wrong word for a lot of people, particularly for atheists. But we need to somehow do, in my opinion. Marie, thank you for the call.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
In fact, I think some sort of a universal resacralization of the world in arguably in a in humanistic, atheistic terms is necessary. So, Chris Christie, tired of hearing about the minimum wage. Kay Hagan, well, I don't think she has anything to do with it, but this flyer has shown up on people's windshields that has a picture of lynching, and, you know, be sure to vote. Of course, the right-wingers are all hysterical about that. It's like, you know, the Black Panther Party has returned or something. Who knows? It's totally bizarre. So, anyway. Back to the issues of the day and your thoughts on the issues of the day as well. Jesse in Miami, Florida. Hey, Jesse.
Hi, Tom. That was a very, very good program last night. The thing that stuck in my mind was the belief and action and how can we make the world sacred. And we are all religious, really. But let me start off with Karl Marx. He says religion is the opiate of the masses. I would disagree. I would say propaganda, beliefs, false beliefs are the opiate of the masses. Proof in being, we have so-called job creators thinking they God. So, but going to Jonestown and Mr. Jones with his cult and just expand it to capitalism as being a religion, how whole United States could be a Jonestown, but getting into what the lady was saying before, she was saying, how can we find a true belief, Jesus Christ? Communism started out as something that brought people together. What would be a rule of thumb for a true belief like the 99%? Let me say this. Seeing them help the people after Hurricane Sandy, see them help people who's getting foreclosed on, that's a universal belief I think could relate to everybody, yeah. No matter what label. Yeah. Now, here's my belief in connecting the Federal Reserve and printing money. The Federal Reserve is printing money for who we know who. My belief is we need to have the, if people could go help me through a hurricane and not get paid for it, I could extend that to say I could work to 100 years old to help people in this world have a way to live and not work one day for selfish, false beliefs of capitalists. Mm-hmm. What, can you connect all these things?
I would say, Jesse, sure. Thank you. I think, you know, the main point that you're making here is that capitalism is basically a religion. It is an economic system, but also the belief that capitalism solves all problems. Capitalism accomplishes some things, but capitalism also has a downside, and thus it needs to be well regulated, because unregulated capitalism is sort of like an unregulated baseball game where there's no, you know, no rules that say here's the number of balls and strikes. Different teams come up with different rules for themselves. They say this is the way we're going to play it, and we've got the most money, so we'll play it this way. You know, that's how. So yeah, it's you know, all of that stuff is. I think, frankly, libertarianism is a religion. Teresa in Santa Rosa, California. Hey, Teresa.
Hi, Tom. I find this conversation on atheism most fascinating. But I have to pose the question, how is the Republican Party a political party in America? I understand Republicans represent corporations, but how are these corporations, American corporations? I understand they want us to defend their wants and needs over in the Middle East, but what do they contribute? They certainly don't pay taxes.
Yeah, what they would tell you they contribute is they give us jobs. But the reality is that, you know, anybody, any business, if they're hiring people, they're doing it because they need those people to make the business work. To presumably make money for the people who started the business. The whole point of starting the business in the first place. So I'm not sure where to go beyond that.
It's not an American company, Tom, and they provide a lot of American jobs, but they are not an American company.
Yeah.
Should we
be willing to throw tremendous, huge resources behind defending their needs and interests?
No, I don't think so.
We already do.
I think it's time for some serious economic nationalism in the United States. And I think that this is a, number one, do away with our insane trade deals. Number two, make it so that any state that tries to compete with other states for corporate favors, you know, will, dear Boeing, if you move your headquarters here, we'll give you more tax dollars and more money than some other state will. Any state that does that should lose all their federal highway funds. So, you know, we stop corporations from manipulating one state against the other and getting more and more and more tax benefits. I think we need to bring back the corporate death penalty. We need to say corporations need to be operating in the public interest first and foremost. So there's a bunch of things there.
We need to bring back corporate death penalty. In fact, we should question, are the Republicans a real political party?
Yeah, or a cult. I think they're a cult. Teresa, thank you for the call. Charles in Augusta County, Virginia. Hey, Charles, what's up?
Hey, Tom, how you doing?
Good.
Hey, on this subject of religion, pretty much, and this is from philosophy classes that I taught, religion is a practice. As the gentleman was saying, capitalism can be a religion. Baseball can be your religion. It's a practice. And I think that the biggest problem we run into is most practitioners do not understand the system to which they pledge themselves. They are more into proving themselves to the leaders of the belief system and their peers. They want to be seen as a group in a group. They want to be able to relate to something. And they really don't, they're not very literate. Mm. They don't study the system that they follow. They want to belong.
But I think one of the really important points that Reza Aslan made in the conversation I had with him, the hour-long conversation I had with him on television last night, was that there is a difference between belief and behavior, and that a religion can say here is what you're supposed to believe to be part of this religion, but different groups of people will behave in different ways based on their interpretation of that. And
what we need to pay attention to
is behavior rather than belief, because belief is ephemeral. Belief is what people assert, but what do they do? It's a version of saying, listen to what people do, not what they say. And
right. It's more important to study if you want to get into religion as a say a deity type religion or faith based religion. It is more important to understand morality, I believe.
You could say that, but see, morality, I believe that morality informs religion, not the other way around. The assertion that I've had no shortage of Christians come on this program and make is that without religion, you have no morality. I think that's nonsense. Morality is, animals get morality, right?
Exactly. Animals, as you were saying about the sharks a while ago and the personalities.
Yeah.
You know, personalities have sharks. Yeah. Animals understand it, in an earth level that people don't.
Yeah, could be.
We get blinded by the information surrounding us. We get into a sensory deprivation from all the stuff we're being bombarded with.
Yeah, our intellect takes the better of us. Charles, thanks for the call. It's excellent points. David in Phoenix, listening to KPHX. Hey, David.
Yes, Tom.
Millennials?
In reference to your topic, and can the Republicans win them over? And that is to say that I need your help to help me out with my thinking here, because I have a great deal of respect for what you have to say. And that is basically that after Goldwater lost in 64, the oligarchs or the extreme right, like Jay Coors and Daddy Koch, they funded talk radio and the right-wing think tanks and invented this idea of the liberal press. And then as time went on, Nixon and Reagan come along and they use the Southern strategy, because it's quite hard to get a lot of people to vote against their own self-interest. And then they come up with this idea of going convincing the evangelicals by going after the gays and what I'm trying to say is the millennials aren't really necessarily going for this stuff and believing it. And so I'm saying these guys are really smart. So What will they do to convince the millennials to vote Republican in the future?
It's a good question. That's a really good question. It seems that this is where the Republicans are betting to a certain extent on Rand Paul. I mean, they're looking at Rand Paul going, huh, this libertarian thing seems to go really well with the millennials. Why? And you know, what the millennials are saying, okay, we don't want to fight any more wars in Iraq and Afghanistan or anywhere else, frankly, thank you very much. And B, we think that criminalizing personal behavior, whether it's a woman's right to choose an abortion or whether it's a gay person's right to get married, or anybody's right to have sex with whom, you know, whomever they want, as long as they're a consenting adult, that this is crazy talk, if a plant can grow, the government, should not be in the business of putting people in prison for having it. Those kind of things make sense to millennials. And so what both the libertarians and the Republicans have been doing is when they talk to millennials, they're trying increasingly to focus on those things and saying, and don't look at the fact that we're saying we should deregulate all business, we should turn the commons, the public areas, over to the billionaires, that the free market is going to be the solution to all things. The free market piece of this is the actual religion embedded within libertarianism, because it's totally a faith-based piece that has no demonstration in reality. David, thank you for the call.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
We'll be back 15 minutes before the hour. The same person from Texas on the line. That's cool. And welcome back, Michael, in Imperial Beach, California. Hey, Michael. Thanks for watching Free Speech TV. What's up?
Hey, Mr. Hartman, about your first hour with Brian Fisher.
Mm.
Now, if Mr. Fisher wants to quote the Bible, I don't know the exact scripture, but it says, "Woe to those who give suck in the final days." Which
yeah,
I believe
Jesus talking in Luke. Yeah,
correct. Okay, thank you. But that means it means those who have children, knowing that it ain't going to be good for them. So I'm 52, never been married, no children. I've chosen not to have a child in this world situation with the destruction of our food chain, 200 species being lost a year, global climate change, the creation of GMOs. Do you think it is prudent to have a child in our current world situation? Thank you, Tom.
Thank you, Michael. I think that there have always been times when the world seemed to be going to hell in a handbasket. In fact, there have been times when people were quite certain of it. For example, 1346 until 1350, the 4 years of the Great Plague, the Black Plague, the bubonic plague in Europe and in the Middle East. It was a time, I mean, it eliminated between 40 and 60% of all the people alive in those regions. And you read the writings of people in that era, they were convinced the world was coming to an end. This was a sign. This was it. That's one of the more visible ones. But there have been a lot of times in our history where we've looked around and said, oh, this is terrible. That said, when the Constitution was written, there were only 1 billion people. There were fewer than a billion people. There were half a billion people in the world. In 1800, but 1800. So that was, 25 years after the Constitution was written, we had our first 1 billion people. 132 years later, as FDR is sworn into office in 1932, we hit our second billion people. Our third billion people didn't take 130 years. It only took 30 years. That was when JFK was sworn in. We hit 3 billion people. The next billion people didn't take 30 years. It only took 14 years, 1974. So as Jerry Ford was sworn in, we had, our fourth billion, excuse me. The fifth billion took only 13 years, 1987. The sixth billion took only 11 years, 1996, I think it was, 1995. The sixth billion, now we're on our seventh billion. So we're seeing this exponential curve. So there is a serious problem with population. Now, is the solution to that for all of us to say we're not going to have kids? I don't think so. I think the solution for that is to empower women around the world, because you've got lots and lots of places where women have no political power, no literacy, and the two tend to go in hand. And as a consequence, they're having lots and lots of children, and they're basically subject, the slaves of, essentially, they're the men in their lives. And so we need to be empowering women all around the world, particularly in the developing world, in the third world. That said, you know, Louise and I have three kids, all in their 30s. We have no grandchildren. I've never overtly, explicitly had this conversation with my kids, but I know a lot of kids, a lot of people in their 20s and 30s are saying, you know, we're not going to have kids. And I think maybe for the reasons that you're articulating, I think, frankly, in the United States, there's more people who are doing it just because they feel economically uncertain, which is the other great legacy of Reaganomics, is we now have, I mean, this is the millennial generation, it's the first generation coming along that not only is screwed by Reaganomics, but knows it. And that's where the Republicans and the Libertarians are doing their very best to prevent them from knowing. We'll be back. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Sam, a sane person from Texas in Houston. Hey, Sam, what's up?
Hey, Tom. I love your show. First time I called in because I can't stand it when people from Texas call and represent us all like that. First, please allow America to forgive us for the Bushes and Rick Perry and remember us for Ann Richards and Barbara Jordan.
Yeah, I was going to say, you got a lot to answer here for, Sam, but you're right. Ann Richards and Barbara Jordan and a lot of other good people have come out of Texas. A lot of good is good.
Oh, exactly, exactly. Yeah. But, I mean, I wanted to call and say, first, I work in public education, and a lot of public school teachers here in Texas are really young, usually within 5 or 10 years right out of college. That guy's completely off. Everybody here who is in that age bracket is a Democrat. They're the ones who are changing Texas. And we all, the people who are thinking, of course, realize that our insurance premiums are lower, even though, thank you, state of Texas and Governor Perry, our insurance does, excuse me, suck from the state. Obamacare has brought our premiums down, and with small increases. My insurance increased by $8 a paycheck this year.
Yeah.
That's the lowest increase I've ever experienced in my career.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm with you. Sam, thank you for being a sane listener to SiriusXM there in Houston. I appreciate it.
We've got to get out. Yeah, we've got to get out people to vote because we're within striking distance to get Wendy Davis and Letitia Van de Put elected over the crazies who are on the other side.
There you go. And Wendy Davis would be a great candidate. Sam, thank you for the call. Thank you very much. Kurt in Los Angeles, listening on KPHX. Hey, Kurt, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Hey, I wanted to follow up on your couple of callers ago who was asking the question as to what could the Republicans possibly do to try to get millennials to vote against their own best interests. And what I think and what I saw coming down the pike a long time ago is that they're trying to blame this jobless recovery on President Obama when the Republicans have been the ones blocking every jobs bill that the president has put forth suggested to Congress since he got into office.
Yeah.
And so that's what they're doing. I knew it was going to happen this way.
You're absolutely right.
I don't pay attention to, you know, who does what and where. And I keep trying to tell people the Congress has the purse strings. They are the ones who actually writes the checks and creates the budgets that creates jobs. All the president can do is suggest this is the direction we need to go, but it's up to Congress to approve it. And so, I mean, that's what they're doing.
Yeah.
And also, we need to light a fire under Bakersfield. There's a Democrat in the running against McCarthy. And I've already started talking to some people and networking with some folks in the Democratic teams out in my area.
Mm-hmm.
If you're thinking about doing a caravan to Bakersfield, people, mm-hmm. light a fire under Bakersfield. There's a chance to get to upset McCarthy.
Okay. You got it. Kevin McCarthy,
right?
The whip?
Yep.
Wow.
Yep.
Amazing.
He only got 58,000 votes in the pre run up. So I mean, there's more than a couple million people in this area. So
wow.
We just got to light some fires. We can do it.
Do you have a website for his opponent?
No. It's a guy named Raul Garcia, and he has no website, no phone number. He only got in with 300 votes for the Democratic side, but he was like the second runner up. So
right. They
take the top two people in whatever race.
Right.
But he's virtually. McCarthy's been running unopposed for I don't know how many years. Finally, there's a Democrat, but he has no network. So me and some folks are trying to get a hold of him, trying to track him down, see if he can give us a photograph so we can build him a website or something.
Well, good luck, Kurt. I wish you the very best. I would love to see Kevin McCarthy get a run for his money. Thanks a lot for the call. Matt in Cazenovia, New York. Hey, Matt, job creators?
Yeah. I've heard so many people say that the rich people are the job creators, and my dad retired in Cape Cod, and I've been there in July and been there in November, and the people disappear, and if these rich people were job creators, they would just create the jobs
right. And
keep people there working all year round, and that would attract all the customers and, you know, prove that the rich people are the job creators, but that's not how it works.
Yeah, there's a really simple way to know who's a job creator and who's not, and that is the percentage of their paycheck that they spend versus save.
Go visit Cape Cod, like I'm saying, at
right. Those
two different times a year, and it's painfully obvious
that
there's no one there,
yeah. And
you can't have jobs if there's no customers.
Well, the people the larger the percentage of your paycheck that you spend, the more you are a job creator because you're stimulating the economy. The larger the percentage of your paycheck that you save, that you stash in Swiss banks or whatever, you are not a job creator because that money gets taken out of the economy functionally and put into savings. And what you find is that people who are on the very bottom of the barrel, people who are on welfare, people a little farther up the barrel who are, you know, working at poverty wages, those people are 100% job creators. And then you get into the middle class where people might be saving 1, 2, 3, 4% of their paycheck every year. Now you're getting, you know, they're 95 to 98% job creators. And then you get to the Mitt Romneys of the world who are, you know, yeah, he might be, you know, spending $1 million to put a car elevator in his latest mansion in Malibu. And it may create a few jobs temporarily. But most of his money is going into trust funds. He's got $100 million in trust funds for his kids. You know, it's stashed away. He is an anti-job creator. He's a job thief, if you were. So, Matt, thank you for the call. We have a little less than a minute to go, so it wouldn't be fair to put a caller on at this point. But I just want to really reinforce this point that libertarianism, republicanism, the right-wing economics, austerity economics, whatever you want to call it, this stuff that the Republicans have been pushing – and their absolute opposition to the president having any kind of legacy whatsoever, the caucus room conspiracy, the plan to destroy the Obama presidency and the Obama legacy, in part because he's a Democrat and in part because he's black. These things are what are dragging down the middle class in the United States and dooming an entire generation, the millennial generation, to, you know, $1.18 trillion in just student loan debt. Much less everything else. And we really need to take it on. And the step one is waking people up. Thanks so much for being with us today. We'll see you tomorrow. Don't forget, democracy starts when you get active. It's not enough to just vote, although you got to be sure and do that in 2 weeks. Tag, you're it. We'll see you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to tomhartman.com.